Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Simon Oldfield, Jesse Jetpacks and Ben Ockery to discuss A Short Affair, a new collection of short stories tied together with work from some of the Royal Academy's most exciting graduates.
Then we'll be discussing sound art as Monocle's Augustine Macellari meets Rachel Pym in anticipation of her forthcoming performance in Whitechapel's legendary Bell Foundry.
And I'll be talking to author and sports journalist Mihir Bose about what to expect from this afternoon's England-free World Cup final.
Oh, shame. That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We'll be looking ahead to next week's news and we'll enjoy some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Ding dong. What a ding dong week it's been, Tom. It's been something like 30 degrees every day here in London. Outside it's been dry, but tears have been shed here on the playing fields of England.
Indeed.
On the playing fields of Moscow.
Indeed, Rob. It's a tragedy.
Yeah.
England not in today's World Cup final.
Yeah.
We was robbed. No, we weren't. We were just terrible.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, look, there's been lots of other interesting things happening. It was funny. Midori House was possibly rattled by the arrival of President Donald Trump. Was
yeah.
it towards the end of last week? His big old helicopter came rumbling overhead. The walls were shaking. I called out a welcome message.
Yeah.
Saw you doing that. POTUS.
I didn't know your sign language was quite so concise. So we talked about a little bit of last week's news, what was happening, but who do we turn to for next week's events?
You know who it is. There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me, for liberty, Fernando.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I have an exciting three stories for you guys. I'm afraid that they might sound a little bit repetitive, but nevertheless, they have three very interesting and important stories.
Okay.
Equal measure, by the way.
I like. Don't sell yourself short before we've tackled
No.
Topic A.
You were talking about the World Cup. I mean, of course, today is the big final, so it does count as next week's events, and it was France against Croatia. But most importantly, I was reading in a Brazilian paper, some people, they suffer what is called the post-World Cup syndrome. Mm. And I was reading about it, I was like, oh my God, I have post-World Cup syndrome. And I think I've been having the last ones. You know, it is a sense of sadness when the event starts. You kind of come back to reality and perhaps in a very sharp way. Nevertheless, I think it could be a good final.
I think I was suffering from that before this one started.
You're already predicting. But, you know, it's very important for Croatia. If they win, they'll be the smallest populated country to win a World Cup. They have less people than Uruguay. I think they're about 4.5 million people. So it's massive for Croatia, a fairly new country as well. Mm. And they've been to a semi-final back in 1998. So I like this political aspects of it. And I think if France wins, you'll be politically very good for Macron as well. You know, I think that's what the image.
Up.
Yeah. Remember when France won in 98, people saying, look, this is the diverse France we want. You know, everybody was cheering and celebrating. And then you had, you know, riots. You had,
I was
going to
say,
Front National.
Didn't really deliver. Yeah. Everyone was like, this is our rainbow nation moment.
Yeah. We have to be more skeptical this time.
It didn't really happen. And 20 years on, a lot of those problems are kind of the same, really.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
And our next story is actually Helsinki. From tomorrow, you know, Trump is meeting Putin there in their own very little summit. That would be a very interesting summit to see. And I was checking, what are they talking about? From what I can see, apparently cybersecurity will be a big topic. And they will kind of try to sign some sort of agreement saying that they're not going to interfere in each other countries' politics. Well, I don't know if they're going to respect that.
I mean, two honourable and trustworthy individuals.
Of course.
Fine, upstanding. Okay.
But guys, we're ready. Are you ready for the final story? And perhaps the most important of them all, maybe? I have a clip for you and then we can discuss off the back of that. Let's hear it. There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me. For liberty, Fernando. I've heard all
so
sorts
good
of
they
names.
Named him twice.
Yeah. Well, it's time for Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, the most expected film of the year, of course. That was Cher singing with Andy Garcia.
Cher and Andy Garcia?
Singing Fernando, because Andy Garcia is Fernando in the film. And Cher is playing the grandmother, the kind of the wicked grandmother. And I mean, Cher is just an amazing character,
love Cher,
guys. I mean, yeah. I've seen her interviews. I mean, she's still going on. You know, she's very much also against Trump, but in a very funny way. So if you follow her on social media, she does have some amazing things to say. And come on, this film, it is the year of ABBA again. You know, they will release new songs later this year. Mm. Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again.
Was it kind of hologrammatic tour or something? Was that?
Yeah,
or are
that,
they going on an actual
that's
tour?
That's happened, hasn't it?
Oh, that's and been think, gone. Hasn't
yeah,
it?
But I think
I'm not as across this as Fernando, obviously.
There'll be some specials. I think there'll be on the BBC and NBC as well.
Playing new music or old favourites? Or
a
bit of both?
There will be new music.
Wow,
which is
so exciting.
No, but that's breaking news because, you know, ABBA was one of the few bands that they never kind of reformed or anything. And guys, isn't it magic that Cher is singing Fernando? I don't know, it's like a dream coming true.
I was going to say, you couldn't have commissioned.
Yes.
If you had all the money in the world and all the contacts, who else would you rather have sing a song that could be about yourself?
No one.
Yeah, I thought so.
You know, not even stuff. Madonna.
Well, I said no one because for better radio effect, but yes, Madonna as well.
Okay. Right.
Madonna as
so
well.
So maybe for the part three of the trilogy.
Exactly.
It may yet happen.
Mamma Mia, we're still here.
Fernando, thank you as ever for a stunning news look ahead. Coming up next, you could hear a pin drop. Since 2012, Pin Drop Studio has been a powerful voice speaking up in support of the short story. In collaboration with different luminaries of the stage, the world of art and, of course, of literature, Pin Drop has worked to bring short stories to a wider audience.
The studio has attracted praise for its live events and taken its support of the form even further, commissioning new stories from leading writers and searching out fresh talent with its annual short story competition. Now, Pin Drop's releasing its first collection, A Short Affair, a book of the best of the short stories it's commissioned over the years.
The book's been made in collaboration with the Royal Academy and has drawn from its pool of talented graduates to bring together a body of visual art reproduced on the pages alongside the stories. And we're now joined by Simon Oldfield, Pin Drop Studio's co-founder and an editor of A Short Affair, as well as the artist Jesse Jetpacks, whose work appears on the pages, and the writer Ben Ockrey, who's contributed a story to the collection. Welcome, everyone, to the programme.
Lovely to be
Thank
here.
You.
This is going
to
be a good one, isn't it, Tom? We've got a juggling match here on our hands.
Just don't drop any of us.
Congratulations on a beautiful, striking visual piece of merchandise here that sits on the table.
Thank you.
The cover's done by Eddie Peake, the artist.
Right.
How did you, Simon, I'll start with you, the idea to string it all together, to tie the visual art to the short story?
I suppose we have to go back to the very beginning when I started working with my co-founder, Elizabeth Day, who is a journalist and author. And my background is I'm a curator of the visual arts. And so we had an idea that we wanted to bring together and unite art and literature. And it started in my gallery where Elizabeth would read short stories in response to the themes of the exhibitions I curated. And before long, we were inviting other authors and other actors to do the same. And then we moved to bigger stages like the Royal Academy. And from the Royal Academy, we've been working there for a number of years and curating a programme alongside their main exhibition programme where we invite authors like Ben Ockrey to come and read their stories in response to the themes of the exhibitions at the Royal Academy. So it was a natural fit and progression, really, to put it together and have it in something as tangible as A Short Affair.
I like that you call Ben, despite the fact that he's sitting just opposite you here around the table, Ben Ockrey, using his full name. always.
I always do. He insists on it.
Contractually obliged to call Ben by his full name. Exactly.
Maybe it's, I can like, ask... it's not like it's 17 syllables.
Can I ask you about this intersection of visual art and literature? It has an enduring fascination for many. It's something you've written about and worked with before in previous works of your own. Why is it always so exciting what happens at that intersection, do you think?
Well, my last book is a book called The Magic Lamp, and it's a collaboration between myself and Rosemary Clooney, the artist, and 25 stories, 25 paintings. And it's very simple. It happened the other way around in this particular case. The paintings came first, and I responded, went into the paintings. But the reason why the intersection is so fascinating is because you're dealing with different worlds that actually come from the same depth of the human spirit, but they're different responses to the richness and the mystery of life. You could have nothing more polar opposites in many ways than a painting or a piece of installation and a piece of text. They massage different parts of the brain. With a piece of visual art, you actually see it not completely, almost never completely, if it's a great piece of painting or a great piece of art. But you have to see it repeatedly with the eyes or with other senses. With a piece of reading, with a piece of text, you have to imagine it. It creates the image in your mind, as it were. To bring these two spheres together is an act of magic, maybe even sometimes an act of alchemy.
That's pretty well said. So, Jesse, this is an interesting one for you because you've done a line drawing to illustrate the story that you've been paired with. This is not like your regular work. Some people kind of think that the short story is a bit of a palate cleanser for longer fiction. Is your line drawing, does it kind of help to recalibrate the rest of your work? Is it a sort of a nice exercise?
I think the problem with my work is I don't really have one kind of way of working. I really do make like an unrecognisable variety of things. And when I draw, I do tend to use line and quite graphical, flat images. I'm not really very whimsical with a paintbrush, and I like to involve, you know, Photoshop a lot, although I didn't with this one. It's kind of hard to articulate how that would tie in aesthetically with the rest of my practice, but I suppose the approach to what went in the image and how the image was rendered would be similar to the rest of my practice, in that it's an ongoing investigation and reinvestigation into how feelings relate to actions that you then have to complete.
I want to ask you about the tie-up between the, about, you know, when you get the brief, as it were, when you read the story for the first time and react to it. But I want Ben to have a go at me about describing the short story as a palate cleanser for the longer form of literature. I'm sorry.
The short story is a good, strong drink on its own, onto itself. It's a world of its own. The short story is the extraordinary enigma of actually evoking a universe, a world, few pages. Anyone who treats the short story as a palate cleanser is going to lose at the World Cup.
Thanks.
He went straight there.
Yeah, didn't he? Yeah.
Well, when you knock the short story, we come out fighting, don't we?
I'm actually, limping off with a groin strain here.
Yeah, in every interview that I've ever done with any of the authors, whenever that question sort of comes up from the audience as well, there's this immediate reaction. It's like very prickly to it.
The hackles are raised.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
And Ben, your story, it's got a painterly-like quality to it. And I wondered whether actually you were riffing off a painting. It was such a visual story. It's called The Lighting of the Lamp, by the way. And it's so kind of rich in texture and things. It seems like quite a painterly thing. Have I got that wrong as well?
No. You got that absolutely right. Yeah. You got that right in a way that you would not guess. If it is painted, it's because I am and was a frustrated painter. One of the first things I wanted to be was a painter, a composer. All of the things I failed at, writing came about 20th down the list. It just tells you, just keep on going down that list, you'll find something. No. Yeah, I'm very, very, your instinct is absolutely right. I'm interested in the textuality of the world. And it's where poetry meets painting, in a way, the way in which image is distilled, the way in which you're always looking for the one thing to stand for the many things. It's the short story, it's the sonnet, it's the poem, it's the painting. It's we're keen on images, we're keen on one thing that multiplies many things. You really nailed a secret frustration that leaks into and informs a lot of my writing.
But I like your idea of the short story as a strong drink. Like it's a martini or it's a Tom Collins or something. It's something that kind of hits you between the eyes, right? That's something that it should do.
And you're left reeling 2 days afterwards.
Yes, it lingers. I think that's also the point as well. And that's what the most powerful, most successful short stories have that quality, most definitely.
Jesse, I wanted to know about that link when you get the brief, basically, when you read that story for the first time, whether it's in its edited form or whether it's kind of almost like the manuscript or whatever you get. How was that? What was that like, getting that kind of through the post or on your email and kind of having to then use that as a very obvious kind of stimulus for something visual?
I think it's imperative to use that as the obvious stimulus because the brief is responding to the story. Mm. And I was very excited to receive it. And I read it about 5 times before I even thought about how I'd approach it, because I'm quite wary that you get an idea and then you kind of stuck with that idea because you had that idea. And I wanted to have feelings and emotions about it. And it's quite, I don't want to give away much of the story, but there's like a lot in there that really sort of spiraled off in all these different directions of what I could do. There's a kind of like, I mean, there's a lot of codified signifiers in my artwork that unpacking can be a bit dry. And in the same way, I feel like unpacking literature for me can be a bit dry, just enjoying it. But I try to use filmic imagery, like the sort of classic film poster with the
that's what it reminded me
like
of. Yeah,
epic in the facing different directions and the kind of drama, because the story has all this drama in it, but it's so sparse as well. It's like
a sort of power play in the story.
Yeah,
right?
It really mixes like detail and intricacy with a kind of like suburban nothingness and this absence of, you know, real drama and this like fantasy of drama. So
Simon, can I ask you a bit? That's interesting. You know, Jessie's reflecting there on sort of her artistic response to the literature. Does it matter whether we look at those responses as artistic or illustrative? I mean, I guess you could argue it's a semantic point, but given what we were reflecting on earlier about this meeting place of the world of visual art and literature, does it matter? I mean, when you were talking with your contributors, did you describe, oh, well, this would be the artwork we'd like to see, or this is the dream, or did you talk about illustration? Does it matter?
No, and I think actually it's really important for us to treat each of the artworks as independent works in their own right, and they've all been produced as original works, as independent pieces that will be hopefully exhibited on their own at some point. The stimulus, as we said, the starting point is the story, but they should, and I believe they do very successfully, have their own life beyond the book, which is very, very exciting for, I hope, for the artists and for us too. But pairing them was what was very interesting for us, and you know, going through the artists and thinking about which stories might work well with individual artists. And we didn't put any parameters around our brief apart from produce something that will respond to this story. The only parameters we gave were the dimensions. It had to work on the page and be reproduced well. We obviously had thought very carefully about, you know, how to pair those stories and with the artists. And I think, I hope, that it has been very successful. And we were amazed when we got Jessie's back because it's so powerful. Yeah. It captured something in the story, which I sort of hoped it would. But, you know, I suppose my hopes were met and exceeded, which is amazing. And also, to your point, which parts of the story, which elements would you draw out? And I think it's been interesting to see how you have captured both the urgency of the story but also the suburban quality as well, and yeah. I think that's what's really great about it and very successful.
It's like it has this like giant boiling feeling going through it. I wanted to say as well, but I forgot, the main character, one of the main characters, like the main thing that resonated with me about them was the absence of touch, and so I tried to represent them with that like absence of touch, and everything around them is so like touchable. They're just like existing in this way, and it's really intriguing how this main character sort of navigates that.
And it's also very interesting that we didn't put the artists and the authors actually together, because we wanted to allow, again, it's about freedom for each individual art form, where there were no parameters around the writers. They were allowed to write whatever they wanted to put on page, and we respected that. And the same with the artists. So we didn't, as the editors, put any parameters around it for the artists, but nor did the authors on the artists. They were both given as much freedom as they needed. And I think the results, therefore, are better for it.
Yeah, and they're not obvious. Some of the connections are obvious, and some of them are sort of pictures of the things you see in the story in a way. But I like the fact that a lot of them are very loose. Yes. And someone's really taken that line for a walk and it's gone somewhere very far away. Mm. And you have to read the story once or twice at least to see some of those subtle connections and things. It's very nourishing, actually. Yes. And satisfying to find those links and to kind of ease yourself into it. I wanted to ask you also about Pin Drop itself, because there's a big performative element. This is something you've been doing right from the start of founding it, you and Elizabeth. And looking at the way, I know you've obviously had Ben reading, I think it was this story, but earlier stories as well, I think, as part of Pin Drop. How is this going to work? Because this seems like a gift for something like Pin Drop, to have wonderful stories read by the authors and then having this visual art element standing by it. You kind of feel like that's when it comes alive in a sort of different way.
I think we've created our perfect backdrop, our perfect sort of platform.
Yeah, you've got such good stuff here. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's what's so amazing about, I suppose, Pin Drop is the way that people come together and they collaborate, and the way that we approach it as an organisation is it's very organic and things come together when they feel right. And so, yes, this book has been born out of originally the live programme and putting together art and literature. But from there, of course, it will flow in the other direction, and we hope very successfully so, where we will have the writers and actors performing these works and reading them against different backdrops, different stages, whether it's at the Royal Academy or elsewhere. But of course, we do have these artworks as well, and we hope to exhibit those at the same time to create this much more contextualized environment for the audience. And I think that's part of what we do. We take care of our audiences. We think about how they will want to receive this story and hear the story and the artwork as well. So yes, we have created, I think, I hope, a great thing for our live programme as well.
Yeah, quite an intense event, quite an intense evening. You've got all the stuff there. You know, you want to be down the front for that.
Yes. Yeah.
And I guess when you read something that's the product of a collaboration, or you see a piece of visual art that's involved collaboration of one sort or another, it can be so impactful. It can almost be just the best thing when you see how these minds meet. Ben, is there a secret to a great collaboration, whether it's with an artist that you're working with, or I guess even with an editor
respect.
Or a co-writer? Is there a secret?
Respect.
Is that the absolute
respect?
That's the alchemic ingredient.
Yeah,
absolute respect. And by respect, I don't just mean respect in a street sense of respect and you throw a fist up. I mean like really, really respect the integrity, the spirit, the intelligence, the playfulness, the waywardness, the personality of the person you're working with, to respect even the aspects of them you don't even know about. Respect their surprise. Don't try and can them. Don't try and limit them. Don't say, we can only go this way and this is the best way to go and you're good at this, you do that. No. Welcome people being unlike themselves. Encourage it. Dance with whatever they give you. Spiral higher. Respect. Many people I've collaborated with, they respect is a very difficult thing. It's as difficult as listening. It's as difficult as loving, I guess. It's as difficult as trusting. I love people who, they surprise you and they're waiting for your surprise. They're not trying to determine where it'll come from. They're just waiting for it. And when it comes, they're like, wow, okay, it's my turn to leap. Mm. And mutually, we kind of leap through the skies. Yeah.
Ben, I wanted to ask you about, we talked about Jessie's kind of stimuli for this. She read her story, her given story five times before she kind of allowed herself to feel something for it. And then before she put a line on a paper, on a page kind of thing. I wanted to ask you about stimulus for things. And the short story is such a powerful form. It does something, it's just a different form to the novel. Are you looking for a line of almost a quote or a piece of music or a brush stroke, as you say, that art has inspired you so much? Is there quite a direct link between something that you find inspiring and the later way that worms its way into a story or informs a whole story for you?
I think the impulse for a short story, more than a novel, is I'm going to describe it really graphically, forgive me. It's an arrow to the heart or an arrow right to the middle of the forehead.
Mm.
It's a feeling you have that is so sharp and so clear, so distilled, so strong. And it's usually one thing. It's never two, three things strung together. It's all the great short stories, they're like a really awful punch to the solar plexus. They hit you somewhere deep inside. They can do it very insidiously, very gently, seeming not to do it at all, but it's usually one big effect. And it's not an effect that is built up to. It doesn't have to be built up to. It can just be the surround of the whole thing. It could be the way in which it's patinaed and layered, the way in which the images work inside it. But it really comes down to a unity. It's the short story is about unity. It's about singularity. And so for me, it's a piece of music. It can be a walk. It usually is an incident lost in my mind a long way back. Sometimes it's a recent experience that has something, some element in it I don't quite understand. A completeness of understanding never gives rise to a short story. It's an incompleteness of a feeling that gives the impulse to write the short story, because you're trying to uncover.
You're trying to find the answer.
You're trying to find the answer.
The ending,
trying to uncover something.
Exactly. Or suggest the ending.
Yeah.
Could an illustration then, or an artwork to accompany that piece, complete the circle? I don't know, if you look even at the artwork that accompanies your story, in a way, does it make you reflect differently on your own writing? Can it do that?
Yeah, they're parallel experiences and one changes the other. I bet when I read the story that's been illustrated and the painting itself, as you were saying, the more you read the story, the painting changes, and the more you look at the painting, the story changes. Because that's what art does. When art impinges on another art, they both change one another. They both become something different, don't you think?
And it's interesting, yeah. We've been having that same kind of comments from readers as well, who have already read the book. They've read the story, they've looked at the image independently of one another, then they've read the story and they've gone back to the image. And it's either reinforced or slightly changed their initial reactions. And I think that's really good. That's something this book is doing, and I think that's great. And where your writing is concerned, I think there is something so musical about the way you use language, and you definitely, I think you get that in this story here.
It's a strange love story. Simply said in one sentence.
It's great, though. I was so into it. I read it twice. I was really into it. It's kind of very sexy. It's so moody. I kind of felt like, I kind of had a smoky jazz soundtrack. I had something going on in the back of my mind. I could write a playlist for this story.
Thank you. I loved it. I thought you, when you paused, I thought you were going to say you had an erection while you were reading.
Well,
That's where he was going with that.
That's why I always broadcast in shorts, Ben. I feel like actually the short story, you spoke so sort of poetically and precisely about what the short story is to you. And I feel like it's almost like waking up with a bruise. And then kind of remembering that actually you...
How did I get that?
Yeah, how did you get it? And then you remember that you had a really good night the night before. It's a bit like that.
Well, you don't quite totally remember it. You just start with the bruise and then you go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And that somewhere else that you go to is a parallel autobiography of what you forgot. It's very, very strange. You always start with something. You go somewhere else. But years later, when you read that somewhere else, the place that it originally came from is in there in a very... indirect, fractured sort of way. It's really weird the way the mind works when it forgets and remembers creatively.
Yeah. There's also an element to your story which has that too. I mean, it has a time span to it. You sort of begun it a while ago and then finished it more recently.
It's an old story. I like old stories. I write stories. Time is an important part of how I write stories. So this has been there for about 5-10 years. It's not never quite complete. I'm just waiting for a new stimulus, as it were. And then here came Simon. Simon says, look, I want a story. I want a sexy story. I want something that's got this. And I'm like, I know exactly the story for
you.
Brought it out, rewrote it about 5, 6, 7 times, and it was ready. I've got to explain something about The Lighting of the Lamp. Does anybody know where it comes from, title?
No.
The Lighting of the Lamp, T.S. Eliot. Just in case you read the story. Just another layer.
Finally, Jesse, I wanted to ask you, we talked about Ben's different stimuli that inform his writing. What about for you? Is it music in the studio? Is it a line you read in a newspaper or a story? Is it one scene in a film or like the corner of a very well-known painting or something? Maybe it's naive of me to suggest that these might be something that inspires you, but where does that come from for you? Is it a similar sort of process to the one that Ben's talking about?
For me, I think a majority of my projects that I actually complete come from a kind of wrinkling against my experience of social culture, as in just sort of existing in a kind of inherently compromised but ultimately non-structured existential way as you navigate, you know, experiences, whether, like you suggested, they're art or music or, you know, food or TV, walking about. It's kind of like I don't have a specific focus or space that I can draw from. It's normally where I encounter something that doesn't quite compute. And then it's in turn amusing and distressing and I'm curious about it. And I'll write something. You know, I'm not a good writer, but a lot of my work starts with writing. And because I can't write, something else has to come out of it. And it will like transform and then come back to me. And a lot of the time I employ the philosophy of like telling a shit joke over and over and over and over again until it has to be funny again because you've been so obnoxious.
Yeah.
And then it all floods through.
Okay.
And that's when it makes sense.
As another potentially more unlikely collaboration then, could you work with a great writer to say, I don't know, see some of your works presented and rather than the curatorial hand, a writer to give their, I don't know, more novelistic impressions. I mean, maybe even Ben could do it. That'd be quite a fun thing to do, wouldn't it? Would that work? Because it's the same process, I guess, of relying on another artist to riff on your work and see where they take it.
I would feel incredibly privileged if anyone who is a writer would even look at my mad ramblings. I mean, other disciplines are a beautiful mystery to me. I think anyone who's attempting some kind of creative phenomenon has got something going for them that would undoubtedly enrich whatever I've got going for me. So
I do bad drawings when I'm writing certain pieces and they're very helpful. I'm not going to show them to anybody ever.
Thanks indeed to Simon Oldfield, Jesse Jetpacks and Ben Ockrey.
A Short Affair is out now, and if you'd like a fix of storytelling in the flesh, Ben Ockrey will be giving a reading of his story this Wednesday at White City House here in London. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Now, Rob, we were talking about the extraordinary intersection between visual art and literature. Shall we bring a third cultural strand in?
Should we add a tine to the fork, the tuning fork?
Yeah, I think it's tine for some new music.
Yeah.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
This is the title track from US singer John Grant's new album, Oof. Love is Magic.
So tragic.
And that was new from John Grant with Love is Magic. And you're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Now, next Saturday, the 21st of July, we'll see London's Whitechapel Gallery reaching out into its immediate surroundings for inspiration for its Nocturnal Creatures showcase, a one-night event that looks to cultural and historic venues close by to create new art.
Among the artists participating is Rachel Pym, who'll create a sound and performance work in the space once occupied by the Bell Foundry, an industrial enclave that made bells, including London's Big Ben, and even the Liberty Bell in the US.
She caught up with Monocle's own Augustin Macellari to tell him a little more about the fascinating history of materials her performance will be drawing on.
So Whitechapel have an exhibition on at the moment called the London Open, and my work is one of the, I think, 23 artists that are selected to be in that show. And they have this really exciting kind of programme that runs concurrent to it. So it's basically an opportunity to do a kind of performance work at the same time, because I work across a lot of media. So
I was going to ask about that. So performance isn't something that you're necessarily too new to. It's been part of your practice for a while.
Yeah. I work a lot with video and sculpture, but sometimes making that is the more interesting part than the finished product. And so the performance has become this work in progress look-in for the audience. So yeah, right. I've been doing it for about 10 years, I guess.
Oh, that's great. So it's like an opportunity to perform the process.
Always. Yeah, exactly.
And when you came on board with it, was it always clear to you that you wanted to do something that directly related to the Whitechapel area?
The premise for the event is that it's all within easy walking distance, so it's really nice that the audience can go and see, you know, multiple kind of events all at the same time. So it's just a coincidence, but I really like working in factory settings and understanding kind of processes and how things are made and materials and the steps they go through to become the sort of stuff around us, basically. So the fact that there's this factory setting nearby, I think that the curatorial team kind of knew that I would know what to do with it. So they were like, hey, come and have a look at this building. And I just walked in and I was like, this is absolutely amazing. Started banging on stuff and moving things around and exploring. So it makes a lot of sense to my way of thinking.
Right. And it's because it's not just any factory either, is it? It's like this really iconic Bell factory where they cast Big Ben, you know,
and the Liberty Bell. Yeah, it's been going since the 1740s. It's been operational, only recently decommissioned. So although none of the working machinery is in there at the moment, it's actually all gone to the London Metropolitan Archives has it, so you can kind of go and see it still. They've been running tours there on weekends for the last, I don't know how long, but I've never been to see it. So it's really nice to basically be able to like run around in this building that has this insane history and loads of stuff still in there because they've cleared it out. But I've been walking around and salvaging things that might be like a ladle for some molten metal, or might be a hoist that moves like a 10-ton bell around. So you can see the history really on the face of the building when you walk in. It's all really present.
We were talking about that before we started. So you were saying that in the past you've lived in Guardian properties and there are Guardians living in the factory now. And one of the amazing things about that kind of way of, you know, living in the city is that it first of all does bring you into contact with these unreal buildings, but also, as you say, often they're just full of relics.
Yeah, there's something quite interesting about being a guardian, because you're in this like interim part of its history and you know that it's about to have this other purpose, and there's a tiny moment when it's not functional. And so living in those spaces means that you get to experience a little bit of that slightly melancholic, bittersweet kind of thing, but also learn about it from lived experience.
Yeah, bittersweet's definitely the word. Have you had any sort of indication of what's going to become of the foundry?
Yeah, I've been kind of getting access to the building through the architects who are actually designing the new development, and they're in the consultation phase where they kind of show the audience all of their little models and their plans. It's basically going to be a hotel on one side. You can imagine the kind of hotel that you might have in a grade 2 listed historic building. It'll be nice, right? But then the front they're keeping as a kind of viewing gallery and an open cafe, and they've got this kind of wedge of public space. And that's potentially going to be quite nice, actually. They'll keep some of the like fascias of the inside of the building and some of the bells that are there that ring out certain peals. So yeah, and the courtyard there is very beautiful.
You spoke briefly earlier about your interest in materials. Mm. And I wanted to ask a bit, because I understand that this is going to be an exploration of the materials that were used in the process of bell making. And I wanted to ask how the history of those materials and processes in your research related specifically to the Whitechapel area, or you found it relating to the area.
That's a tricky one, because for me, well, there's two things I can talk about. One is the materials and one is the sound element, because this is the performance, is a sound performance. When I met the owners and talked to them about all the different things that are involved in the process, so what do they say? Clay, tin, copper, loam and horsehair. And I was like, okay, can you tell me all the names of all the suppliers? Because I want to basically get an order of all of the stuff you would have normally used, and that can become the sculpture or the basis to make a kind of set, basically. And they were like, well, it's actually really hard, and that's part of the reason why we're going, because, you know, like, horses don't, like, walk past the front of the building anymore, you know? They were like, yeah, the horse shit's not right anymore because they're not eating straw in London. They eat straw in, like, Kent. So they're like, so that's where we're going, like, following the horse shit. They kind of, yeah, understand the how funny it is that their materials are kind of outdating themselves, or, like, city-based manufacturer can't really rely on city-based suppliers because what a city is has changed so much since 1740. Part of the same change as why there'd be guardians living there and a hotel being built. It's the nature of a city changing over time. The other thing that's really interesting is the clay supplier, which is a company called Bulmer Brick and Tile. They mine the clay that's used for the to cast the outside shell of the bell from a London Eocene seam, which is where all the London stock brick comes from. So again, there's this really particular relationship to a place in the ground where the material comes out of, which is nearby, but also the fact that this material is a really prolific, known kind of quality of the city as well.
And so the foundry itself is now relocating out of the city, is that right? Or is it shutting its... I mean, is the company shutting its doors completely?
The company and some of the employees have gone to Kent, mm-hmm. where they do small bells, handbells and that kind of thing. Catherine, who was one of the owners, is a handbell ringer. She keeps inviting me to concerts, which sound amazing. I haven't made it to one yet. And then various of the other employees have gone to work in other parts of the handbell industry. And I think the really big bells get cast in a place in Loughborough now.
To go back to the sound element then, bell ringing?
Because it's a collaboration. So I tend to work with other people quite a lot, especially when it's a live thing, partly because it's just more pleasant, right, to do something with a group. And also I think it moves the work forward when you have a conversation. So there's a musician that I'm working with whose input is really kind of half of the work, but also whose work inspires a lot of what I do anyway. So he's called Graham Cunnington. He was a founding member and a current member of a band called Test Department. They formed in 81. They're industrial musicians. They would describe themselves as sonic material handlers or industrialists or agitators. So there's a political side to their work. In 84 and 85, they collaborated with striking miners. They kind of go into these amazing buildings in a similar site-specific way to how I really enjoy and play the building and play the objects.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and that gets mixed into music, industrial music.
So that's part of, I guess, it kind of how it's like painting a sonic portrait of a building, isn't it, in some way? And then in this performance, you're going to be drawing in that alongside these materials in this environment.
Yeah, so there's physical materials that get moved around by a series of performers, some of which are former staff, so that's really exciting to get their choreographic input onto how they would have used them, some of whom are the guardians who live there. So all of the people in the building who are doing the performing are part of the process of how the building has changed. And then, yeah, Graham and I will be working together on the sound to figure out, I suppose, way of giving voice to this transformation. What does an object sound like when it's not in its use anymore? What did it sound like when it was being used? What could it sound like next as a kind of narrative transformation of matter?
Hmm. And has it been fun working with Graham?
He's really fun to work with, yeah. We've done a soundtrack before for a film about rubber, and I gave him lots of audio from different factories I'd visited in India, and it's quite banging. It's like quite a good listen. Yeah, he's really, really talented.
That sounds great.
It's technical music, and it's also quite challenging to hear and sort of mathematical to an extent. I really like it.
When it comes to working with the guardians and the former employees of this building, obviously there's a political idea to be drawn out of that. Is that something that you're interested in people pursuing when they come to the performance, or is it more about covering the like wholeness of the space and of the building in its different kind of iterations?
Well, I guess the question of who you'd work with is always there anyway, and it's really important to me to kind of have a connection to a real process that has happened somewhere. And because I suppose inherently moving things around in a factory is about labour, it makes sense that you would use local labour, the most local labour, right, the people who live upstairs, but also to honour the opportunity to give people who whose work was at the foundry the opportunity if they're interested. Somebody is, so that's great. And also, yeah, because there's money involved and there's a budget, I would want to reinvest into the parts of the process that I feel are niggly politically or like tricky, like somebody who is in a process of having not had that job anymore, or, you know, somebody who's a precarious liver.
Mm.
So yeah, of course it's totally political. And the same goes for the materials. I think of them as being quite political agitators or like motivators in the work.
In what respect?
In the respect that taking something out of the ground and using it and selling it is like, you didn't ask permission of the clay, right? I mean, there's a sliding scale about how much things are animate or inanimate. Taking a horse and asking that to do labour, there's an ethics to that. But maybe you could apply those ethics to like a plant, when people take a plant from one country to another. And then maybe the same should go for things like mining. That's kind of the extent of my politics.
Thank you to Rachel Pym and her performance and many other fascinating works. We'll be on show at Nocturnal Creatures this coming Saturday, the 21st of July, at and around the Whitechapel Gallery in East London. This is the Monocle Weekly. A little later today, Croatia will be kicking off against France, the culmination of one of the more remarkable World Cups of recent years. I'm now joined, I'm delighted to say, by Mihir Bose, the author and sports journalist, to discuss why it's been a competition almost unlike any other. Mihir, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Good to have you with us. It's become something of a cliche over the few weeks, certainly as the football has unfolded, that it has been, you know, the tournament of shocks. We saw big teams go out early and so on and so forth. France have made it through, which perhaps we'll come to. Just in football terms, with your sports journalist hat on, has this been right up there? Has it been one of the best tournaments, as some have been saying?
Yes, it's been a remarkable tournament, because normally in football tournaments we have some early shocks. You know, there's some team that goes out, but in the end the favourites come through, whether it be Brazil, Germany in recent years, Spain or something like that, they come through. But this time, right from the beginning, it's been a very topsy-turvy tournament. First of all, there were these big questions. Would Messi finally win a World Cup? And it was quite clear that the Argentinian team was nowhere near as good as Barcelona in supporting Messi. Messi himself looked distraught often, as if he didn't want to be there. He didn't look right. And in the end, they struggled to get out of the group and were beaten by France, today's finalist. Then Germany, who were sort of almost certain, it seemed, to get to the final, didn't even get out of the group stage, which is, for Germany, absolutely remarkable. And again, Spain. Spain and Portugal had an opening match which suggested that this would be a very good World Cup. But then again, Spain, just before the World Cup, they sacked their manager. So you had all this drama. And the other drama that one must say is that before the World Cup, there was a lot of fear that Russia would produce violence, the crowds would be difficult, people shouldn't go. And actually, there have been huge crowds, many coming from overseas, and we have had no problems. So what has happened is countries, England, of course, is a good example, Croatia, sort of was a dark horse that came through, and Brazil. I mean, Brazil actually, if you take shots per target at goal, shots at goal, Brazil's record is the best in the competition. But Brazil just couldn't put the ball away.
Which is, again, if we look back over history, certainly a surprise. Do you think that reflects, Mihir, certainly in terms of the surprises, perhaps that we shouldn't be surprised, and that maybe there is a diminishing of the distance in quality terms between the sort of teams that were there to get a shellacking in the olden days and the best sides? Are we seeing an equalising or I don't know, a sort of more equitable distribution of footballing talent? Because some of the sort of no-hopers of yore, you know, they're now producing some really, really solid sides.
they're still the odd one. I mean, the Saudis looked pretty poor. Panama and England's group looked terrible from the Central American qualifying. But generally speaking, is the quality across the board coming up? Could that be a factor?
No, the quality across the board is not coming up. Africa didn't do all that well. Asia didn't do too badly, but South Korea beat Germany, but Asia didn't do all that well. What has come out is that Europe is a dominant power. Mm. You know, even before the semifinals were settled, all the teams were European. South America is out of the picture. The World Cup traditionally used to be every 4 years, the title would rotate. South America, Europe, South America, Europe, you know, that has completely gone. Brazil hasn't had a World Cup winner since 2002. Argentina, nowhere in the picture. Uruguay are not in the picture. So that is the big thing. And the other thing is that Europe now has players not just who are, well, many of them are born in Europe, but who are of various races and cultures and so on. So these European teams are multicultural, almost multinational teams. So a different kind of Europe is coming in. And the smaller European countries are having players like Iceland and some of the others who have a lot more experience. What this tournament illustrates is the importance of the Champions League. If you play in the Champions League, you look at the players, most of them, many of them play in the Champions League. In next to the World Cup, the Champions League has emerged as a very, very big competition. If you like, the foundation stone for the World Cup. In the old days, it used to be the Olympics, but it's now the Champions League.
That's really interesting. And actually, I suppose if you look at that Croatia team, who will be contesting the final later, unfancied in many quarters, but to a man, almost all of them, plenty of Champions League experience for your Real Madrid, Barcelona, Inter Milan,
Juventus,
AC,
yeah,
all the top sides. And that's something to reflect on. Of course, something that the many English players don't have yet. Let's leave that hanging, because who knows what the future might hold, hopefully. Just to go back to what you said, though, Mihir, about the expectations many had about Russia. Now, we know there's been degrees of stage management. Putin and others have made sure that the host cities have been absolutely, seemingly free of any kind of protest or disruption or anything like that. Does this slightly prove that those who were naysaying about the tournament maybe were overstating the case? I mean, plainly, a lot of problems politically and domestically in Russia remain. We can't brush over that for a second. But in terms of the tournament, you know, hasn't it been rather good? Were we wrong to be so downbeat about it prior to the tournament?
I think we were, and I think the people who were downbeat hadn't looked at the fact that when Russia had the Winter Olympics in Sochi, they staged a remarkable Winter Olympics, you know.
At some cost, we should say.
Yeah, at some cost, but this was Putin telling his people, forget the world, telling his people, Russia is back. You know, Russia used to be a great country. The Soviet Union broke up and things like that. Russia is back. And also, let's not forget, the Russian football team surprised everyone, perhaps including themselves, and did quite well. That was an important factor. And what is interesting is that the spectators have come from far corners of the world. I mean, in fact, normally in a World Cup, the English spectators outnumber every other visiting group. I think in this case, the Panamanian and the spectators from other countries outnumbered the English. So that, I mean, the English probably took on board the dire warnings given. And of course, we've had our problems with Russia in this country, so that's not surprising. From all the evidence we've had so far, very few of them have had any complaints.
Obviously, we've got the final to look forward to in just a few short hours, and we'll ask you about that in a second. But just looking further ahead, obviously Qatar next, and the tournament's taking place at a different time of year than it's ever done before because of the searing temperatures there and so on. Do you think we could have the same experience? Could we be sitting here in 4 and a bit years' time saying, wow, who knew that the Qatari World Cup would be so great? I'm still rather sceptical, to say the least, about that. Does the experience of Russia 18 change that narrative around Qatar 22?
Well, you see, Qatar will introduce another new element. It'll be a World Cup in winter where most of the players now have gone into the World Cup after a long season, a very tiring season for many of them, Champions League, European football, domestic football and so on. They will be going into Qatar as a midwinter break, as it were. I think energy levels would be different. And secondly, by the time Qatar comes, the one factor in the World Cup we haven't so far spoken about is VAR. Now, VAR has made a huge difference to this World Cup. If you see the number of penalties that have been given, I mean, VAR is still, I think, not being very well managed. A lot more needs to be done. But VAR has certainly affected the games. You know, I don't think we would have had so many penalties given without VAR. So by the time Qatar comes, VAR will be embedded perhaps in football. And I think that will make a difference in correcting, if you like, mistakes, the sort of mistakes that used to happen in the past. I mean, England, for instance, got quite a few penalties, which again, without VAR, they might not have got.
And it was interesting, I suppose, on that point about the video assistant referee. Even just during the tournament, the 5 weeks or so, it seemed to be refined and it certainly improved. There are a couple of glitches. So that, I guess, bodes well.
The only thing I would say there is football needs to work out at the moment when the video assistant referee is working. Nothing else is seen on the screen except you see a large room where somebody's watching on, you know, a bank of screens, you know, and it's not very interesting television to see it. They need to do something where the actual replay is shown on television and people can follow. At the moment, neither the spectators at the ground nor we at home can follow what's happening.
Mihir, it's almost as if the powers that be have forgotten to think about the fans in the stadium or at home until the very end. That can't be the case, surely. Let's focus then on the match that's happening in a couple of hours. Now, it is tricky. We're sat here in the UK. We have listeners around the world. But in England, this does feel a little after the Lord Mayor's show, simply because, you know, we were sort of half expecting, half hoping to be there. Nevertheless, an interesting game. Is there any other outcome, though, Mihir, than a pretty comfortable France win? From where I'm sat, Croatia, I know they got very angry at suggestions they might get tired against England. They're going to be exhausted. They're one of the oldest teams in the competition. France has pace and power. They've not really been stretched. Easy French win ahead?
I wouldn't say easy. I expect France to win. I think that the question there is, how does France cope with perhaps the best midfield in the World Cup at the moment? You know, Modric, Rakitic, they are very, very good players. And Modric, really, has been playing in a very unusual role in midfield. He goes very deep, he takes corners, he's playing like a deep-lying midfield general, not in the way that Messi or some of the others midfield players play. So, you know, he's doing that, and therefore I think, and we saw in the second half against England, how he directed operations and basically made sure that Croatia came back. So I think France will have to watch that. I think the French pace, Griezmann, Mbappé. Griezmann played very well. Mbappé he's absolutely electric. Yeah, and the Giroud doesn't look like he really can score, but he does hold up play and things like that. And the French defence is quite good. They've played to a plan. They don't have a midfield general. You'd expect France to win. I think the Croatian problem will be, do they have a goal scorer to put the chances away? Their centre-forward, Mandžukić, hasn't really functioned. And as England showed, the Croatian defence can be put under stress.
But who knows, Mihir? Maybe this World Cup of Surprises has one last one ahead.
Absolutely.
We'll find out in a few short hours.
And I wish and I hope France will win, because I think they're a very fine side. And Lloris is the captain of Tottenham Hotspur, my team. But the point is, I think Croatia could still surprise us.
Mihir, thanks so much for coming in. Can I trouble you for a scoreline? Why not? Let's try and be as specific as possible.
I would think it'll be France 2-1.
There we go. The man has an answer for everything. Thanks for coming to see us.
Tom, that was it for edition 471 of the Monocle Weekly. I felt, I'm the wrong person to ask or have this assumption because I'm not a listener. We do it for them, right? I thought that was a pretty good show. I enjoyed doing it myself.
I really enjoyed that. And can I say, you know, Studio One, it's a decent size.
Yeah.
It never feels better than it does when it's positively brimful with five bodies in there, including you and I, as it was for our chat about A Short Affair. What lovely and intelligent people they all were.
Yeah, was it nice? I loved that. Could have brought that out of the studio Sunday afternoon, taken it across the road. Maybe cracked open a few rosés.
Yeah.
Probably light on the olives, heavy on the rosé with those three.
I'm on board with that one.
Oakry, Jetpacks, Oldfield, Edwards, Bound. What happy band of brothers.
The rest of the short story writes itself. Yeah. And we should say, of course, we mentioned the Eddie Peake artwork on the cover of A Short Affair, which is sort of
very striking.
Technicolour, quite sort of lurid, you know, which may be what people would expect. What they wouldn't expect was Simon Scarf, which it married up almost perfectly. It's extraordinary.
We didn't mention that somehow. We were kind of thinking of the form of the short story and the idea of visual art and all its interpretation.
But it's almost like the book jacket has just grown out into woolens and around his neck. Amazing, an amazing thing.
And thank you to all our pals and guests. Just before we go, are you suffering from what Fernando was talking about at the beginning of the show, Tom? Post-World Cup sadness, a bit of tristesse
a bit.
De football.
The good thing about that, though, is it is only seasonal. And as we tick towards August, the new the new season starts, Rob. So
okay, I'm kind of going to be keeping an eye on the test match.
I can suffer it. I can suffer it for a few weeks, exactly. And there's other diversions.
I was going to say, I'll be all right.
The test match, very much the methadone of sport for me. So there's somebody to look after you during those fallow weeks.
Nice fun. Today's show was produced by Augustine Mercellari, and our studio manager was Sarah Miles. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.